fashion paper swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You could have dealt without a bank account. But it's funny how a lot you fell down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alice O'Connor, who's a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alice O'Connor.
Thank you.
And this latest report suggesting that poverty in this country has risen to 15.1%. This and the total number of people in poverty is an all-time record. It seems a stark contrast, if you will, to what we just witnessed last night, a debate hosted by CNN and the Tea Party, at which Wolf Blitzer posed a hypothetical question to candidate Ron Paul about what would happen if somebody, a young person who couldn't afford health insurance, decided to forego it and then suddenly had a catastrophic situation. And the people in the audience, you know, the question from Blitzer was, would you let this person die? And people in the audience actually cheered and said, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
yeah.
So
I can't say I have been avidly following those debates. I mean, part of me says that I, as a historian, should. So I didn't happen to see that. I'm afraid, though, I mean, I hate to say this, but it doesn't surprise me, partly because I think, you know, that kind of thing is just pandering to people's sense of economic insecurity, and this is something that we have seen over and over again, where it leads to, I mean, in this case, it's not just a backlash against the poor, but I think you have to hear in that this feeling that, you know, when there are all these immigrants around and they're, you know, taking away our social services, so I think that was probably wrapped up in that reaction. But it does speak to, you know, a longer-term politics that has really led to a very powerful and very old, but the resurgence of a very old and powerful discourse that blames the poor for their own poverty, even in the midst of the worst recession, the worst economic downturn that we've had since the Great Depression. It's stunning to me to see how this persists and how it's actually being encouraged with that kind of question and with that kind of a reaction. I mean, that's outrageous.
And the report just released by the U.S. Census Bureau on annual income puts the number of people in poverty at 46.2 million, which is the highest number since the government started tracking poverty in the 1950s. And this probably, I mean, I think it's reasonable to assume that this recession is going to deepen, and a lot of economists think that we're going into a double dip. What's your sense of I mean, I brought up that question just to sort of get a kind of temperature, if you will, of compassion in this country, or the lack thereof. Do you think that there is a broader question here about jobs themselves and the extent to which technology is replacing jobs making people redundant? Do you think that we should have a bigger debate than just this sort of narrow one of sort of shovel-ready jobs versus the Republican argument, oh, we can't possibly spend any more money because we have this terrible deficit looming?
Yeah, I do think, and in fact, you see very little of it, and I think partly it's because people are so caught up in this sense of what we have to do tomorrow to get income in the hands of people who are simply trying to get by, and also get incomes in the hands of people who will spend it, and also trying to, you know, stave off the politics of extreme austerity. So in some ways, it's understandable why we haven't had the broader conversation. But it seems to me, I mean, this is, again, a conversation we have been needing to have for years, that actually, you know, steps back and says, what do we make of the changing nature of work in the United States? How, you know, why are we continuing to, you know, insist that in order to get any benefits whatsoever, people must be in the workforce without actually providing the conditions within which people can get access to work that pays both the wages and provides the benefits they need to sustain themselves. Now, in order to, if we're going to continue to be committed to this work-based approach to economic security and to all the benefits that come along with, you know, economic and social citizenship, if you will, in the United States, if we're going to continue to insist that work is at the center of that, it's an obligation. We have an obligation to think hard about how we provide the work. Now, does that mean a shorter work week? Does that mean expanding our notions of what should be compensated, what kinds of labor should be compensated? Does that mean going back to a model of growth that's led by full employment, which would mean you do have to make massive investments in things like building, new kinds of infrastructure? I mean, not just shovel-ready jobs, but really changing the kinds of things we produce in the United States and investing in that. We just are not having that conversation about whether we should be, again, changing that whole workplace model, the old work-based model, in order to accommodate a changing economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Alice O'Connor, who's an historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. We're talking about the just-released U.S. Census Bureau's annual income report that puts poverty at an all-time record of 46.2 million people in poverty, the highest number since the 1950s when tracking began. It also talks about how our incomes have fallen and poverty has risen, and the number of Americans without health insurance has jumped again in 2010. It also, though, mentions that a growing number of people in poverty are children. And that seems pretty unconscionable to me, again, going back to the compassion index, mm-hmm. if you will. I mean, perhaps there's such a thing as compassion fatigue, but on the other hand, we are, you know, there's an argument out there that the president's putting forth, which is, you know, why do we need to indulge billionaires at the expense of those who really need a break? And I would argue, surely, that the people who really need a break are the kids in this country. It's no fault of their own that they're living in the richest country on earth, growing up poor. That just doesn't sound right.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, for decades now, activists at the national as well as the local level have been making these kinds of arguments, have been pointing out from a matter not just of compassion, but also, you know, an appeal to conscience, as you were sort of indicating before, but also as a matter of kind of bottom line economic interest. It is ridiculous, and it is certainly against anything we've ever stood for that we would tolerate, you know, the shame of the nation to have such high levels of poverty and need in what still, you know, we still try to present ourselves as the world's most affluent economy. And by many measures, we are in terms of the total wealth that's produced in the United States. But as inequality grows and as the benefits of that wealth are funneled increasingly to the very top, I mean, the uppermost reaches of the economy, we just, you know, even as we do that, we continue to ignore the growing numbers of people who aren't just in need, the need that means, well, you know, you need to stretch out your paying some bills every now and again, but the kind of need that means they are faced with the situation of having no source of adequate income for the foreseeable future. I mean, this is just, this is a world that we thought for a moment and we struggled for quite a while over the course of some decades to leave behind. And now we seem to be not only tolerating it, but in strange ways justifying and embracing it. Somehow in the name of whether it's promoting self-reliance on the one hand or of insisting that this is the only way that we're going to continue our own path to recovery and growth. I don't see how that adds up by any standard of logic.
Again, I'm speaking with Alice O'Connor, an historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. And the debate, of course, or the lack thereof, often is characterized by the Republicans and by the wealthy that they represent as class warfare. But arguably, the wealthiest class has won hands down. And yeah, you know, we could consider ourselves all prisoners of war in a lost class warfare battle. My sense, though, is that things are actually getting meaner. I started out by mentioning the people, you know, yelling out at the Tea Party CNN debate last night, saying, "Sure, let the uninsured person die. Pull the plug." But the sense that that we have this large number of children in poverty, etc. I'm not sure that compassion is the best argument. And how do you sort of restructure or represent the notion of the American dream? We have this, perhaps it's an illusion that we are this middle class country. All of the people in the middle class are entitled to the American dream. There's a sense that we're all being downsized. How do you create solidarity, if you will, in an environment where there is, I think, this kind of divide and conquer mentality, particularly exhibited by the Tea Party, that we've got ours and we're not going to share it with all you minorities and freeloaders?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in some ways that the notion that we are going to somehow convince those people that they ought to get beyond the kinds of redistributive policies, you know, downwardly redistributive policies that would, you know, restore us to a much fairer and more just economy, and also a stronger economy. I just don't think trying to win their hearts and minds is the way to go. I think actually the way to go is to build a counter movement, and that is what to me is going to win the day. The strategy is not necessarily to convince people who clearly have dug their heels into a certain way of thinking and a certain politics that benefits the haves at the cost of the have-nots, and that puts the, you know, interests of certain groups of individuals above those of the greater public, but that also traffics in this kind of meanness that you talked about before. I just don't think they are going to be convinced, and to try to bring them along and to build consensus is not what's going to change the direction of the economy at this point. What's going to change the direction of the economy is building coalitions of people who embrace the values of economic fairness and economic justice. And I actually remain convinced that that's the majority of people in the United States. But the majority of people are not being represented. Certainly the people who show up in those poverty numbers are not being represented in our politics and political political discourse. But also, you know, the majority of middle and working class Americans who really are continue to suffer from the Great Recession, their voices are not being represented in current debates in Washington either.
So just in closing, Alice O'Connor, when we talk about building new coalitions and in effect putting some, I guess ultimately it comes down to putting the wind behind the president, who ostensibly is trying to help the unemployed and to restore and revive the economy, but he's clearly not going to get any help from the Republicans. And unless I think, and of course, progressives are all whining and carping about how he hasn't done enough, so they don't have his back. I'm not sure who has the president's back at this point. But it seems to me that an obvious coalition, at least in terms of intellectual ammunition, is coming from the majority of economists who are saying, and these are the Wall Street people, because you recall after the debt ceiling hostage crisis was resolved, the market tanked because the smart money know that you can't take $1 trillion out of a sick economy and do anything else but perhaps create a double dip. So a lot of economists are saying this is our economic policy is insane, and that the president has the right ideas, and it would be a win-win. It would put people back to work. And let's face it, this study that we're talking about from the Census Bureau has just pointed out that unemployment benefits have kept 3.2 million people out of poverty in 2010, and that Social Security retirement benefits did the same for nearly 14 million seniors. So why want to unnecessarily impoverish your fellow American citizens? It's a win-win if you know, it's what goes back to what JFK said, mm-hmm. A rising tide raises all boats.
But it only raises all boats if you make the effort to make that to create the conditions of shared prosperity. I mean, it doesn't automatically. The rising tide does not automatically. You need a different kind of policy, and a different kind of political economy in order for a rising tide to raise all boats. Look, that kind of politics has, in our past had enormous purchase. And like, again, to sort of build on this notion of purchase, the whole idea of building coalitions around the need to expand the majority's purchasing power as a matter of economic interest, as a matter of getting the economy going again, is something that, you're absolutely right. The majority of economists are going to say that is what we need to do. It is just unfathomable and inexplicable to me why, though, we have allowed ourselves, to get to the point where the voices of economic irrationality are prevailing in Washington. I mean, there's not a simple explanation for this.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alice O'Connor. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, you too.
And again, I've been speaking with Alice O'Connor, who's a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Domenico Lombard, who's an Italian scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's a specialist on international monetary relations and global currencies. Italy, of course, is called too big to fail and too big to bail in terms of the euro crisis. And Greece, of course, is poised to default. There's a panicked conversation supposed to take place on Wednesday between the French president, the German chancellor, and the Greek prime minister. But most people think it's basically a question of whether or not it's going to be a disorderly or an orderly default. But Italy, of course, is very key Dominica said that I asked him about the reports that China is going to buy sovereign debt to try and stave off the pounding that Italy's getting in the bond market. He seemed to think that they were actually looking for some good assets to buy, some companies that are successful Italian companies that have a large stake of government, where the government has a large stake in these companies, might be what they're really after. But he certainly thought that the Europeans have been consistently behind the curve. They don't have the institutions and the mechanisms to deal with this. It is not a very encouraging picture. The Secretary of Treasury is going over on Friday to meet in Europe. The President has already expressed some concerns. The general impression you get is that it's somewhat out of control, and I wouldn't bet on Europe holding this thing together. Then we spoke with Aaron David Miller, who has been a veteran Middle East negotiator. He served 6 Secretary of State. He has a piece in Foreign Policy, Humpty Dumpty Palestine. I asked him about the Saudi warning that if the U.S. vetoes Palestinian statehood, it's going to change relationships, and a veto by the U.S. is going to only help Iran and Syria and further isolate America. He seemed to think things are so bad, at any rate, in terms of U.S. Relations in that part of the world, it's not going to make a lot of difference. But his main point is that as bad as the situation is, and as much as the U.S. is going to get a black eye out of this, we shouldn't be too romantic about the idea of a Palestinian state. And he went on to list the various components that make this Palestinian state so dysfunctional and disparate. Particularly, you've got Gaza, you've got the West Bank, which the Israelis heavily control, you've got East Jerusalem, you've got almost more Palestinians in 58 refugee camps, and then, of course, you've got 1.3 million Palestinian Israeli citizens, and there's no cohesion between these groups. So he was giving a pretty dismal picture of it. And then finally, we spoke about this new report by the Census Bureau on poverty in America. 46.2 Americans now in poverty, many of them children. It's an absolute outrage. And what more can I say? It is absolutely disgraceful. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by